Hello, welcome to The Wire, where you can get independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are in Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
So we were already seeing these large outbreaks of thousands of cases from diphtheria all over the world. And with the pandemic and the disruption, we're likely to see more outbreaks in many parts of the world.
A second case of diphtheria was recorded in New South Wales just 2 days ago. These are the first cases of the deadly disease this century, which caused so many deaths prior to the vaccine becoming available. Also on the program...
This molecule we discovered from the spider's venom was also very effective in stopping heart and muscle cells dying after a heart attack.
One of the world's deadliest spiders might be about to save lives after a University of Queensland research team revealed that its venom could be used in a drug that minimises the damage caused by heart attacks. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. The east coast of Australia has been battered by rains and floods fuelled by the La Nina weather system. But the rains themselves shouldn't take all the blame. Housing development, green spaces and urban planning all impact flood risks in urban spaces. Jono Wakeley asked Professor Elizabeth Mossop, the Dean of Design, Architecture and Building at the University of Technology Sydney, just how housing development impacts flooding.
It's sort of like the other way around, really, in that the issue is that when you put development in the wrong place, it means that it's going to be continually impacted by flooding over time, you know, as we are seeing in parts of Western Sydney currently.
And why does development on floodplains occur? What's the motivation?
I guess historically, towns and settlements were often located in close proximity to rivers and waterways because of transport. In more recent times, generally through the land use planning process, we have tried to avoid putting development into floodplains. Hmm. And I guess in earlier times, the risks of flooding in these areas were perceived as being much less than we are actually experiencing now. The risk equation has become much more severe in recent times, so that, you know, we're getting a bit of a change of thinking around it, because I think historically people have thought, you know, this floods, you know, maybe every 10 years and maybe that's an acceptable thing for people to live with, whereas now in some parts of Sydney, you know, we're seeing people experiencing about, I think it's their fourth major flood in the last year, and, you know, much greater threat to life and property, which is not really acceptable.
How can we tackle flood prevention in the long term?
We can't prevent floods. What we need to think about is how are we going to develop our cities and towns in such a way that they're going to be resilient to flooding, more resilient to flooding, because the thing about flooding is it's going to happen. And we know the impact of the climate crisis is that storms are going to be both more frequent and more intense. So we're going to have more flood issues to deal with. We need to plan so we are not putting people's houses and businesses in places where there's going to be an unacceptable flood risk. Plus, we also have to really work with the places that are going to be impacted by flooding, houses and businesses that are already in places with a high risk. What can we do to mitigate that risk? You know, and so that is things like, how can we improve evacuation routes? Are there ways that we can redesign river channels to provide them with a lot more flood space? Are there greenways or are there floodways that we can create to put the floodwaters in places where it's not going to pose those kinds of risks to people?
For the short term, how should we be preparing for the rainy season ahead? I know Bureau of Meteorology said that there would be more rain later this year with more La Nina. How should we be preparing for flooding now, and how should we be preparing on an individual level later on this year?
People who live in the floodplain area really need to be well informed about the risks. There was a survey done that suggested that up to 80% of the people who lived in the floodplain were not aware of the risks. So public education is a part of this, and you know that's something that state and local government need to really step that up so that people are well informed about what is likely to happen. People also need to understand what it means when an evacuation order comes through and how to evacuate. And are there things that they can do for their own properties, whether it's their businesses or their houses, you know, to safeguard their property? You know, if it's two stories, can we put stuff, can we take everything up to the upper level? Can you store things in the roof? All of those kinds of questions, you know, and there's not a lot else.
How should we be looking at rebuilding and recovering from this flood season?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we take the opportunity to build back better. It's always a great temptation after a flood to just try to get back to normal as fast as you possibly can. But I think the important thing is to really understand what the risks are and try to build back in such a way that we're mitigating those risks so that people are less vulnerable next time it happens.
Professor Elizabeth Mossop, the Dean of Design, Architecture and Building at the University of Technology Sydney, speaking there with Jono Wakeley.
Hi, it's Costa here from Gardening Australia, and I absolutely love listening to The Wire.
The second case of diphtheria in New South Wales was diagnosed 2 days ago. These are the first cases of the disease this century. An unvaccinated 6-year-old in northern New South Wales contracted the serious infectious disease from a toddler who's currently in intensive care. Diphtheria has been a historically deadly bacterial disease that affects children the most. The combination DTP vaccine provides very good protection against diphtheria, tetanus and whooping cough, and has ensured that we have had very few infections in recent years. I asked Associate Professor Meru Steele from the Faculty of Medicine and Health at the University of Sydney to explain why diphtheria is so dangerous for children.
Diphtheria is a disease that mostly affects your respiratory tract, but can often also your throat infection causes. It's caused from a toxins, so like chemicals that are produced from a bacteria called Cornibacterium diphtheriae or Cornibacterium ulcerans. So it's a type of bacteria, and it's the chemicals that are produced by this bacteria, and it can affect your throat and your airways, so your pharyngitis, etc., and can cause an infection and inflammation. And it can lead to like these grey white patches on the tonsils that can then form this membrane and difficult to breathe and swelling of the neck, which is called a bull neck. Essentially, because it really leads to that swelling. So it looks like a bull's neck, and it spreads from person to person. So it is mostly a mild disease, but in about 10 to 20% of the cases, it can lead to death. So it is quite a dangerous and contagious disease. Of course, we don't see much of it in Australia because we have a highly effective vaccine against it. And due to our strong vaccination programs in Australia, we haven't been seeing that many cases of diphtheria in Australia in the last few decades, for that matter.
Because it has been a very deadly disease for children. I noticed one of the stats was that in the Second World War in England, there was more children died of diphtheria than from the bombing of Great Britain at that time. So it was quite widespread, wasn't it?
Yeah, it used to be very, very widespread until the vaccine was discovered. So it was one of the most prevalent disease, but then the vaccine was discovered in 1923. And then the introduction of the vaccine all over the world has led to this massive decline in the disease all over the world, but particularly in children. And it is extremely fatal in children.
So this second reported death in New South Wales, is that a bit of a warning sign as far as you're concerned?
Look, I think from what we understand, and I haven't yet come across all the detailed data of where the first case may have contracted the particular diphtheria from. It's not per se a concern for the immediate community, widely speaking, because we have high immunization coverage. Of course, it's a reminder that if anybody is unvaccinated, for diphtheria, and it often comes as a combination vaccine with a couple of other diseases. So when you get vaccinated for diphtheria, you also get protection for pertussis, which is whooping cough and tetanus. So it's not a concern widely speaking, but it is a concern because what we do know globally is that there were gaps in vaccination against diphtheria as a disease all over the world. And due to the pandemic, in many parts of the world where, because of disruption to their vaccination program, because either staff were working on other things or people couldn't get to a health facility to get vaccinated, we've had seen this decline in immunization or vaccines all over the world, similarly for measles. And so with that decline, what we expect is to see larger outbreaks of things like diphtheria and measles. In 2018, we'd looked at some data and we'd had massive outbreaks of diphtheria across the world in Haiti in 2014, Venezuela in 2016, Yemen in 2017, Rohingya population in Bangladesh in 2017, Indonesia in 2017. So we were already seeing these large outbreaks of thousands of cases from diphtheria all over the world. And with the pandemic and the disruption, we're likely to see more outbreaks in many parts of the world because programs have been disrupted, which again means that there's a risk of importation to Australia. We haven't had that much disruption to our vaccination program, but if there is somebody unvaccinated, it's really important that we go and get vaccinated as soon as possible for these diseases, including diphtheria.
And what about older people that have had the vaccine many, many years ago? Are you finding, like with some other of the diseases that we're vaccinated against, that it isn't lasting for a full lifetime?
I think that the diphtheria vaccine is highly effective. And it lasts, there is in Australia, it's recommended at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. And then it's followed by boosters at 18 months, at 4 years, and around the age of 12 at a national school level program. And adults often recommend it if they miss out on their vaccination as a child. But it's a highly effective vaccine that lasts a lifetime. There is, under the National Immunization Program, there are clear guidelines into when you should get vaccinated. But it's a highly effective vaccine that lasts you a lifetime. But it's important to have your complete vaccination course. So if anyone's unsure, they should talk to their GP or look it up on the Department of Health website and check whether they're fully vaccinated for diphtheria or not.
In order to achieve population immunity, there need to be a percentage of the population that needs to be vaccinated, wouldn't there?
So diphtheria is a little bit different to other diseases that way, but we do need high vaccine coverage. And Australia does, by and large. I think we're over 95%, which is why we're not at risk of large-scale outbreaks.
Associate Professor Meru Steele, Sydney School of Public Health, Faculty of Medicine and Health at the University of Sydney, speaking with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire, around Australia, on the Community Radio Network. A research team at the University of Queensland have developed a drug with promising potential to minimise the damage caused by heart attacks and strokes by utilising the venom of one of the world's deadliest spiders, the funnel web. Cardiovascular disease are the leading cause of death globally, taking an estimated 17.9 million lives per year, according to the World Health Organisation. Sophie Coghill asked Professor Glenn Smith, group leader at the University of Queensland Institute of Molecular Bioscience, how the research team first discovered the venom's benefits.
We were trying to see whether we could prevent the brain damage after a stroke initially, and there was an ion channel, something on the outside of nerve cells that lets ions in and out, that we thought was really important in the development of the stroke. And so we were trying to find something that would inhibit that channel. And what we did was look in our collection of venoms. We had the largest collection of venoms in the world. And the reason we look at venoms is they're the best natural source of molecules that will modulate the activity of these ion channels. And in looking at collection, which contains venoms from a variety of different animals from all around the world, it turns out the winning molecule actually came from a local spider, the venom of the Gari funnelweb spider just north of Brisbane. And what that molecule does is block the activity of that channel. That channel gets activated in after a stroke, and what it does, unfortunately, is send suicide signals to the nerve cells and causes them to die. And so what our molecule does is block the activity of that ion channel. The suicide signals don't get sent after a stroke. And what we do is spare a lot of those nerve cells after the stroke begins. And so the patient, we hope, has more chance of both surviving
and also having a better outcome after the stroke.
So you said initially it was to do with looking at sort of the brain, but now you've found that it's actually really useful for the heart. Can you talk a little bit more about the findings with that?
Yeah, so that was an exciting development. We were initially interested in stroke, and because it worked so effectively, we were able to show that we could still give the drug 8 hours after stroke, which is what we call an ischemic injury, an injury due to lack of oxygen. It worked so well, we began to think, well, maybe this channel is important for other organs that are really susceptible to this kind of ischemic injury. And the organ that's most susceptible to a deprivation of oxygen is the heart. The reason we can only keep a donor heart for about 4 hours before we transplant it, because it starts to die fairly quickly. So very fortunately for me, soon after we made that discovery, Nathan Palpant arrived here as a group leader at the Institute for Molecular Bioscience. And Nathan is a cardiac physiologist. And I said to Nathan, what do we know about this channel in the heart? And he said, we don't even know if it's there. So we embarked on a study to see if it was there. We found it was really important in the context of a heart attack as well, and also in the context of heart transplant. And we're able to show this molecule we discovered from the spider's venom was also very effective in stopping heart and muscle cells dying after a heart attack. So because that's kind of an easier application clinically, that's the first one we're going to go for. We're going to try and see if this molecule will be able to preserve heart tissue after people had a severe heart attack.
When would they be taking this drug, Professor King? What would that look like?
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. It turns out the problem at the moment for stroke in particular is that there are no drugs that will protect the brain after a stroke, none at all. There is one molecule that is used to try and reperfuse the heart or the brain, that is to remove the clot, called TPA. The problem is if you have a stroke, there are two kinds. There's an ischemic stroke, which is a clot in the brain, which that molecule would be useful. But there's also a hemorrhagic stroke, which is a bleed in the brain, for which that molecule could actually make things much worse. And so you can't use it for hemorrhagic stroke. And that's a dilemma for the paramedic. The paramedic might find somebody who's had a stroke, but they don't know what kind of stroke it is, so they can't actually do anything. You have to transport that person to the hospital, image their brain, find out what kind of stroke it is, and then the neurologist can make a decision as to whether to use that drug or not. And if the person is in a regional area, for example, and takes many hours to get to the hospital, they're losing 2 million nerve cells per minute during that process of getting transported to the hospital. What we're hoping is our drug can be used by first responders, even in the context of a heart attack or a stroke. So as soon as the patient was found, they could be given some drug, the brain would get protected immediately, and we think that would be really critical to saving as much tissue as possible after the stroke or after the heart attack. So we think that's where we'll have hopefully a profound impact on the management of both stroke and heart attack by enabling first responders to actually deliver something that will be useful to the patient.
Now that the drug has been licensed and with some funding, what are the next steps for you and your team?
In the short term, the major issue is making enough of the drug. We turned out the dose we need to get these effects is very tiny, but the patient population is very large. So working out a manufacturing route for this is going to be take some time because it's a very complicated molecule. But nonetheless, the aim is to get this drug into phase one clinical trials for patients that are having a heart attack by the last quarter of 2023, so a little more than 1 year away.
Professor Glenn Smith, Group Leader of the University of Queensland's Institute for Molecular Bioscience, speaking there with Sophie Coghill.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Volunteering is something that more people in Australia do than many other countries. University of Technology Sydney students are currently in a volunteering program where they go by bus to various regional towns to help people en masse. Today, two busloads of UTS volunteers are in Narrabri to help the people of the town wherever there is need. I asked Gina Cow, one of the organisers and a UTS business management graduate, to explain what the two busloads of students were doing along their two routes in country New South Wales.
Today we're in Narrabri, which is the joint town, which is where the two buses meet.
So you've all come together.
yes, we all come together and mingle with the other bus and volunteer together. But so I am currently on white bus. So the white bus have gone to Kakor and Manduran, and blue bus have already visited Millthorpe and Gallamgaboon. And then we're heading up north with the white bus. The next town will be Bingara, and blue bus will be Bogabilla, which is a town that has a really big Indigenous Australian community, which we try to help out as much as we can as well.
And what are some of the tasks you're doing today?
We've done some potholes. So people have been filling up potholes in this town. There's quite a few potholes around.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of people are experiencing that wherever they are in New South Wales at the moment. So
especially with the rain, yes.
Yeah.
We've painted the tennis court, and then there was also some general cleanup of rubbish along the riverbank.
Oh yeah, yeah. So this is the Namoi River.
Yes,
and so, and it's all about the being a volunteer and in promoting what volunteering is, isn't it? It's the volunteering movement
that you're doing.
And so do you find it rewarding that you're doing this?
Yes, 100%. It is very, very rewarding. Our motto is pay it forward. And our motto encourages people to basically help out and not expect anything in return, because I feel like in the society that we live in nowadays, everything's so transactional. You give something and you kind of want something in return. And this trip really allows university students to volunteer, give their time back to the community. And it's definitely a rewarding experience.
And how is it funded? Who is supporting you to get to these places?
It's funded mostly by the university. So the University of Technology has a Activate UTS. So they provide some of the fundings. But this year we kind of reach out to several organizations. And for example, Bunnings have like provided us some of the tools that we need for the gardening and the weeding.
And the filling in of potholes.
And the filling of the potholes, yes. So we try to kind of reach out to different places that can sponsor us, and whoever is interested or, you know, kind enough to donate, they will, yeah.
Yeah. And are you finding that you're forging new relationships, and you're finding that some people have skills that you didn't know they had, or they didn't know they had?
Yes, actually, yes. Forging relationships is a big one, especially if you're stuck in a bus with 39 other people. You're also forging relationships with the townspeople, and a lot of the times, you know, people that live in the city don't get to interact with people in regional communities, and that sort of relationship is built as well.
And so what have you noticed about those, just general, if you can make a generalization about the places you've been to so far, what do you think that the people in big cities don't realize about smaller country towns?
I guess how friendly they are. We had an incident yesterday where the bus had to stop over because we were just trying to look for the location of the accommodation. A few townspeople saw that the bus pulled over, so they pulled over as well, and they, you know, knocked on the door and asked, do you guys need help with anything? Do you need directions? And I guess if...
And you're all a bit surprised because you thought people wouldn't be normally doing that in the cities,
yeah,
right?
Well, especially in Sydney, no one's going to pull over if you like need help with directions.
No, they'll think, good, that bus is out of the way, I can go faster. That's what they'll think.
Yes, exactly. So. How can I overtake them?
That's right.
But yeah, so I think people are really surprised to see how warm and friendly they are and how welcoming they can be as well, especially with how diverse everyone on these trips are. I mean, people from the city come from all types of backgrounds, cultures. It's nice to see that people in regional towns are still, you know, very accepting and inviting, despite it being like very different for them.
Gina Tower, one of the organisers of The Big Lift and a UTS Business Management graduate, speaking with me there from Narrabri in New South Wales. And that's it for The Wire today. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.